Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities available online at carthage.edu.
I'm really excited to be connecting once again with a very distinguished American by the name of William S. Cohen. I'm sure many of you remember him for his work as Secretary of Defense for President Bill Clinton, and also as a highly regarded member of both the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. My recollections of William Cohen date back to the Watergate hearings, and I remember as a 14-year-old watching those hearings, and even as a 14-year-old ignorant of many matters political, even to me it made a deep impression that here was a Republican choosing to cross party lines and voting for some of those articles of impeachment. Crossing party lines in a way that nowadays is unheard of, and even back in 1974, somewhat a rare occurrence, which left a deep impression on me, and I know many other Americans as well. Well, William Cohen has now gone on to great success as the writer of novels, and the most recent is called Collision, and it is based upon a really fascinating premise that at a glance might seem like the stuff of science fiction, but in fact is rooted to a surprising extent in reality. The possibility of engaging in what one character in the book calls the commerce of space, space mining, possibly the mining of asteroids for incredibly valuable deposits of various minerals and other substances, and how that could lead to great danger even for our entire planet. And that is the topic of this really exciting, thrilling novel, again called Collision, which is published by Forge. And I'm very honored to speak with its author for the second time on the morning show. William S. Cohen, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I'm humbled by the recitation that you were a young 14-year-old boy watching the Watergate hearings. That was a pivotal point in my life, to be sure. But I think you're right. A lot of people around the country and the world, for that matter, were fascinated to see democracy in action and members of Congress debating one of the most serious issues we'd ever have to confront.
So. Absolutely. And we should mention that you were not the only Republican to, in a sense, cross party lines, but nevertheless, for whatever reason, to me, you are the face of that move that you and several of your colleagues made at that really difficult moment in our history. And I wonder, as I first started reading your novel and became reacquainted with this central character, I started thinking about the different ways in which courage plays out in our daily lives. And I wonder, just for a moment, if you could just talk about what kind of courage it took for you and several of your fellow Republicans to take the stand that you did and to cast your votes as you chose to do at that moment. How much courage did it take to do that?
Well, there was a lot of peer pressure, to be sure, in the House at that time. I had not had any previous experience in a legislative body. I had been the mayor of Bangor, Maine, and had been on a city council and on a school board, and those were nonpartisan. And it was new to me to see the kind of ideological fervor that was being expressed or contained that my first year in Congress. And I had come off 6 years of practicing law, 3 as a prosecutor and 3 as a defender. And so the law was very much a part of my life. And so when I went to Congress and was put on the Judiciary Committee, and that's a story in itself, but when I was put on the committee, I was just determined to follow the facts. What were the facts? And if the facts led to one conclusion, then I'd have no choice but to do it. And that's how I proceeded. Even there was tremendous internal pressure, constant meetings, constantly saying we're on one team and we've got to defeat those who are trying to undo the elections, and it's time to stand with the president. And my position was, if he's right, and if he's wrong, then we stand with the Constitution. So there wasn't that. The courage came in, I suppose, and since I knew I was going to lose my next election based on the level and the intensity of the mail that I was getting from my supporters back home. But I decided that was a small price to pay to do something that was so important under our Constitution that whether I came back or not was really not relevant. So I was prepared to lose based on the mail that I was receiving and the phone calls and the threats and all the other things that went with it. And so I think it was just a question of saying, is it worth it to do something inconsistent with what you believe in order to hold onto your seat? And I decided that was not even a close call.
Hmm. One other question, and then I promise we'll get to the novel Collision. Another hallmark of your career as a public servant was your decision to accept the invitation of President Bill Clinton, a Democrat, to serve in his cabinet as Secretary of Defense. That's, of course, a very different scenario, but nevertheless a demonstration of a similar conviction on your part that serving the public good is more important than, in a sense, serving your own party. And that there is something to be said for crossing over the political aisle, as it were. And again, it's something that we see less and less of in Washington. Can you just say a word about that decision to accept that invitation from President Clinton? How surprised were you by that invitation? And was that a decision, that is, to accept that invitation, was that fraught with any risk?
Well, I was surprised. I had announced my retirement from the Senate in January of 1996, and I was preparing to leave. In fact, I had just signed a lease for office space in downtown Washington, and I was going to put my little group together, my two partners. It's called the Cohen Group. And then I got a call from the White House asking if I would like to have lunch with the president. And I said, sure. And I had no idea what he had in mind. And we met, and I was not very close to him. I had shaken his hands at ceremonial functions, I think, 2 or 3 times, but that was it. So we went to the White House. We had lunch together. We talked about philosophy, and that was it. And then I met him about 4 days later. I was giving a speech in Thailand at the U.S. Thai Business Council, and he happened to be attending the King of Thailand's birthday. And then he spotted me from the podium, and I was in the audience. And he came down and he said, I like your tie. And I was wearing a Jim Thompson silk tie, and Jim Thompson, very famous name over there. And the tie had yellow elephants. It was a yellow tie with white elephants. And President Clinton said, are those Republican elephants or Thai elephants? And I said, Mr. President, today they're Thai elephants.
Mm.
And so we had a little joke about it. And then I saw him once again when we were both back in Washington. I went on to Malaysia for a couple of days, and then he went directly back to Washington. And I got another call saying, can you meet again? And then we got serious and started talking about what if. And basically it was quite simple. I told him that if he were to offer the position, if I were to accept it, that he would never have to worry about me going back door to my friends on the Hill saying, guess what these guys are thinking of down here? That if I signed on to his team, I was on his team and would be with him unless there was something so fundamental that struck me that I could no longer serve him. He said, fine. And I said, by the way, there's one condition I have to have, and that is that you never invite me or allow me to participate in a political discussion. Allow me to run the Defense Department, but don't involve me in any partisan politics in terms of stratagems going forward. How you're going to handle other bills or things on the Hill, I want no part of that. And so he said, you got it. So we had a great relationship. He allowed me to run the Defense Department, never involved me in a political discussion, and gave me virtually everything I wanted and needed for the department. And the thing was, this was not an easy decision on his part. There were a lot of Democrats who didn't like that idea, saying, wait a minute, we've got quite a few people here who are pretty qualified, who've been supporting you and have contributed to you. This guy has been on the other side of you. He's voted against you. He hasn't ever supported you. So it wasn't easy on his side, and it certainly wasn't easy on my side, where guys would say, why would you want to serve a Democrat? And I said, well, aren't we trying to build a consensus for a strong national defense? That's what this is all about. And it worked out. It was the best 4 years of my life.
Wow. I bring it up because some of that same sort of courage of conviction is certainly woven into the central figure of your latest novel. Tell our listeners about Sean Falcone, former national security advisor to the President of the United States, who, as this book begins, has stepped away from public service, but still very much cares about his country.
Well, Sean Falcone is my favorite character, and he appears virtually in all six novels in one form or another that I've written. And he is getting a little bit long in the tooth, I might say. He was a POW in Vietnam, and then he finally, when he was let go in the spring of 73, he went on to law school, became a state prosecutor, attorney general, and then became a senator, and served a couple of terms, and then was asked to serve as a national security advisor for President Blake Oxley. And he served six years, and had many things he had to contend with. And the previous novel was called Blink of an Eye. And in Blink of an Eye, I dealt with an issue that many reporters over the years continue to ask me, what kept me awake at night? And I would always respond, the thought of a nuclear bomb destroying an American city. And that's what happened in Blink of an Eye. I obviously couldn't write it while I was at the Defense Department, but when I left public office, I decided to write that novel to say, this is a possibility that we'll have a bomb destroy an American city. The question then will become, who did this? Why did they do it? How could they have done it? And what do we do in response? All in a period of about 3 or 4 days, that would have to be assessed. And so I wanted to show the impact of what takes place and the tension and the pressure to respond against whom. How do we know who set this off? It may look like one country, be another, et cetera. So the complexity, I wanted to deal with that. And so I enjoy dealing with big issues. I worry about the spread of nuclear material. I worry about Iran trying to put itself on the brink of being able to break out and become a nuclear power. And I think that if that is going to take place, then Saudi Arabia will follow. I think UAE, the United Arab Emirates, will follow. I think the Egyptians will follow. And the notion of spreading nuclear material in this age with the kind of radical groups that are out there, it's not a pleasant thought. And so that worries me a great deal. And that was all, you know, factored into the storyline of Blink of an Eye. This story about collision is based in fact. We are in a cosmic shooting gallery, and we are the target in that cosmic shooting gallery. And we have lots of debris that land that head for Earth every day, but it usually burns up in the atmosphere. except that we have these large bodies and they can be very small. For example, 2 years ago, about a 56-foot asteroid, 56 feet in diameter, weighed about 7,000 tons, passed over Russia at 40,000 miles an hour. And it had the blast impact potential of 30 times the bomb of Hiroshima. The same day, another asteroid, which is about twice as big, about 98 feet, weighed 40,000 tons. And again, it passed going between 33 and 45,000 miles an hour. Now, we didn't see either one of those coming. They were relatively small, but if they hit a city, they can do a lot of damage. Well, NASA has been worried. There are roughly a million of those asteroids floating around our universe, and they want to categorize them, and Congress has mandated that NASA be able to categorize them by size. Size makes a difference. LeBron makes a difference on the court. if you're talking about basketball, the bigger they are, for example, if you have, let's say, a city buster is categorized by an asteroid with a diameter, say, of a long home run, home plate to center field, 454 feet, that will destroy any city on the planet. If you go bigger than that, a kilometer, well, now you're talking about extinction time. And so we want to be aware of the biggest ones. And so the challenge is to detect these asteroids far enough out in advance, years in advance, to make sure that we have the capacity to not only detect them, but then to deflect them. And so now you have the situation where the President of the United States wants to bring an asteroid or send astronauts or robots to an asteroid to bring back samples. And the plan is by 2025. So there are plans underway to start getting samples so we can start mining these asteroids. You have private entrepreneurs who also have that in mind because these asteroids contain billions, if not trillions, of dollars worth of valuable minerals. And there'll be an effort made to move asteroids into a sublunar orbit so that either robots or astronauts can actually get on the asteroid and mine it. The issue I raise in this, number one, do we have enough technology deployed in order to see what is coming at us far enough in advance? Number two, are we satisfied we have the technology to be able to move them out of a collision path? And that's what the novel is all about, a lot of murder involved, intrigue, international espionage, et cetera. But I tried to dress it up to make it a little more entertaining. But the fact, and it's not fiction, it is science, is that there are large bodies out there that are potentially on a collision path with the United States, with the world, I'll say. And we can't tell you whether it'll hit in 1,000 years or what'll hit tomorrow. And that's one of the challenges that we face. NASA is aware of it. The administrator of NASA was testifying before Congress and said, with time, we can obviously be in a position to deflect any asteroid. If it's only 3 weeks, he said, it's time to pray. So that's what we're doing now on a real-time basis, is try to make sure we have the capability of detecting and then the technology to deflect. Movies have been made about this. Bruce Willis, Armageddon. We have other movies made from time to time. I wanted this to be a little more in the sense of it's one thing for governments cooperating. The Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, the U.S. all have an interest in space, obviously. It's one thing for governments to be talking to each other, but is there any problem that will be generated if you have private entrepreneurs who see this as a gold rush, namely, let's get us an asteroid, move it into an orbit that we can send astronauts up or robots up to start mining this and get a corner on the market, palladium, titanium.
I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this novel, is because it has us thinking about something that I think for a lot of us has never dawned on us, the intrusion of private enterprise into the exploration of space, although to some very limited extent, that's already a reality. But your novel takes it, of course, a bit further, as have certain works of, for instance, science fiction,
right,
set way into the future. And what you're doing is setting up this possibility in the relatively near future, and setting it up in a way that in which there are some potentially dire consequences for our planet.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we had a major hit in 1908. Again, it happened to hit in a remote part of Siberia, but it leveled thousands and thousands of acres of trees, just wiped them out completely. And had it hit at a different angle in a different place, it would have killed millions. So it's one where we think we've got a pretty good fix on what's out there, but we've also found that you can see an asteroid and then it disappears. We spotted one in 1934, lost track of it, finally didn't see it until 1989, 1990. So just out there, but we never were able to follow it. So we don't want to be surprised. This is about, you know, having total awareness, situational awareness. If you look at the moon, you can see it's not a case of acne that the moon has suffered from, but being bombarded by asteroids. And so we have to be aware of it. It's not something we should be running saying the sky is falling, but it's not something we can afford to ignore. And we've had a number of these space surveillance systems. One has been shut down recently for budgetary purposes. A new system is authorized to replace it, but then we've had something called sequester, where we've cut funds across the board, and that touches all the programs, both in civilian and military. So we just have to be aware this is not something, it's science fiction, it's science. And the science tells us we have to be concerned about it. So I thought I'd turn something into something not just a straight nonfiction book about the threat. Many have been written, but to try and inform and entertain at the same time.
The new novel is called Collision. It is published by Forge, and the author, William S. Cohen. William S. Cohen, you've done it again, creating yet another really, really fine and thought-provoking thriller, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I always enjoy the opportunity to come to understand the meaning of words more thoroughly and more completely. And that is one of the pleasures in reading a new book called Insight Out. Get ideas out of your head and into the world. A book which helps us understand in much more comprehensive fashion what is meant by terms like imagination, creativity, innovation. Those are terms which many of us, most of us probably, use pretty much interchangeably. But they each play a really important role, a crucial role, in successful entrepreneurship in this modern world in which we all live and try to function and succeed. And the author of this book, Insight Out, is Dr. Tina Selig. She earned a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford University Medical School and is now professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford School of Engineering, and also executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. So for many years now, she has been working with young people to help them understand and then harness their own creative ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. She is responsible for a previous bestseller called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and another book called Ingenious, a Crash Course on Creativity. And this newest book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And Professor Tina Selig, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Wow, that was such a fabulous introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. And this is a great book. I have really enjoyed exploring it on a couple of different levels. I wonder if we could start with the rather personal note on which the book begins, with the story you relate of coming across a letter which you yourself had, in effect, written to yourself 30 years earlier.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing story. I mean, really, somebody couldn't have made this up. I wrote this book called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and soon after it came out, I got an email from an old friend I hadn't seen since I was a teenager, and he said, gosh, you know, is this the same Tina Seeley? We went to camp together when we were kids. And so I thought, wow, of course. And I knew that he had sent me a bunch of letters in those days when we actually wrote letters, you know, on paper. So I went through a big box of letters my parents had sent to me when they moved, and I found the letters he wrote. But more interesting, I stumbled upon one letter I had written to myself on the eve of my 20th birthday. Now, you realize I'd written this book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and all of a sudden this letter from 30 years earlier on the eve of my 20th birthday pops into my hand. And the letter basically said, I'm completely lost. I don't know what I'm doing. I have such huge dreams for myself. I have no idea how to get from where I am now to where I want to be. And I could feel that every day now teaching at Stanford, the same thing in my students. The idea that they have such incredible aspirations, and I felt like it was my responsibility to think about how do you actually get your ideas out of your head and into the world? How do you go through that process? And even after years teaching this topic, I realized that there were a lot of miscommunications and wanted to put a stake in the ground that was going to help other people make their dreams come true and sort of live the lives that they dream to live.
I really appreciated something that you said about the way in which at least much of formal education tends to fail its students. And I'm applauding that as someone who happens to teach at a college as my full-time job. So I'm in the trenches with you, but I see this happen, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself. You say at one point, unfortunately, most formal education deals with memorization as opposed to innovation. It focuses on learning about heroes as opposed to teaching students to be heroic. And it presents problems with one right answer as opposed to real-life challenges with an endless number of viable solutions. Here's my favorite line. People should emerge from school with agency, feeling empowered to address the opportunities and challenges that await them. I guess what you're saying is you came to realize in a clearer way your responsibility as a college professor to offer that up to your students.
Exactly. Well, you know, we live in a very different world than our education was designed for, right? It was designed before there was books and the internet, and, you know, people had to get up and lecture to transmit information. But information is a commodity now. We can all find out this information. And the world is changing so fast. It really is our responsibility to teach people, A, how to learn, and how to tap into their passions, so that they can solve the problems that they really want to solve. The world is filled with lots of challenges, and we really need to prepare people to address them, you know, whether they're the individual challenges in their own life to the challenges that, you know, face the planet.
Hmm. Before we start talking about your book a little more specifically, I wonder if you could say a word about this thing called the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. I suspect that the whole reason for its existence folds nicely into what we are going to be talking about today.
Great. Yeah, so I'm fortunate enough to be the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. This is a program I helped build over the last 16 years. And essentially, our philosophy is this. We're in the School of Engineering at Stanford, and the philosophy is that it's no longer good enough for students to come out of school with a purely technical training. They need to understand the entrepreneurial world in which they're going to be working, whether they're individual contributors, running a team, leading an organization, or even starting a company. They need to know how to put together effective teams. They need to know how to lead. They need to know how to negotiate. They need to know how to be creative problem solvers. In fact, to be honest, we say that teaching entrepreneurship is a Trojan horse for teaching very, very important life skills. These skills are important no matter what you do, and you can be entrepreneurial in everything you do.
I guess that's a really great place for us to start, because actually I think that is really crucial to us even being able to take in a lot of the ideas that you share here, because I think the idea of being an entrepreneur or entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial skills, that's a term that we tend to think of fairly restrictively. And I, for one, have never used that term in describing anything that I do in my very busy, complex life. And in fact, in the way that you're using this term, it's a term we should not be scared of, and we should readily apply to ourselves, even if we've never done that before. Explain how we can open up this our sense of what it means to be entrepreneurial and why we should do that.
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. If you came to our offices at Stanford, painted on the wall in very big letters, it says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. And that is the core of what it means to be entrepreneurial. It means seizing opportunities, leveraging resources, making things happen. I am sure you do that every single day in your life. And if you understand that you're an entrepreneur, it gives you that mindset that really you are a problem solver. It's interesting. We had a brand new dean, and she's fabulous, who just started in the School of Engineering, and she's a physicist. Quite talented, and at first she came in and was sort of allergic to the term entrepreneurship. I mean, she was very, very actively saying, I don't like this word. And she went and talked with every single faculty member in the School of Engineering at Stanford. That's hundreds of people. And she, at the end, said, I've changed my mind. I understand now that entrepreneurship is about problem solving, and that that's what we do here, and that is core to the philosophy and the approach that we have here. And so it's something that is super important for everyone to embrace, from young kids to anyone, you know, of any age, that they too can address the challenges around them and come up with really, really creative solutions.
I appreciate how you take this apart in the first chapter of the book, saying that there are three elements to the entrepreneurial mind, that you need to see the world as opportunity-rich. You need to have a specific set of tools for solving problems, and each of those was addressed in earlier books. And this book really points to that third element, which is crucial to successful entrepreneurship, moving from inspiration to implementation.
Yeah, so I didn't realize until I got to the end that this book was the third part of the trilogy. Now, the book's going to certainly be read in any order. They're not designed to be read 1, 2, 3. But what I wish I knew when I was 20 is really about having an entrepreneurial mindset, about seeing the world as opportunity-rich. Ingenious is really, you get to walk right into my classroom, and it's all about the tools I teach about creativity and innovation. That book's called Ingenious. And this book really weaves them both together and shows the relationship between your attitudes and your actions. And essentially, I walk people through this invention cycle, going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship, showing the attitudes and actions that have to happen along the way to really bring your ideas to life.
As you are introducing us to this concept, one of the things you do help us understand the background behind the phrase thinking outside the box, which a lot of us use rather carelessly. And it's so interesting to know exactly the origins of this phrase. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I personally am not a fan of that phrase. And in fact, most of the people I know who teach creativity aren't either. Because it's used as a catch-all. It's used as a cliche. You know, if I ask people, hey, what does creativity mean to you? They go, well, thinking outside the box. I said, well, what does that mean? And it turns out that term comes from the old puzzle that you might be familiar with, where you have nine dots, you know, rows of three dots, and your goal is to connect all the dots using lines, four or fewer lines, without taking the pen off the paper. And the only way to actually do that is to draw beyond the frame, the invisible frame of that box, to allow the lines to connect. And that's where the term thinking outside the box comes from. Now, most people don't know that, and so when they even say it, they don't even know what that means. So I really challenge people to think much more systematically about what it means to be creative and what tools you actually need to make that happen.
Right after you explain the origins of the phrase, you use another phrase which I find really intriguing. And it's really the point of your whole book, but I sort of love the way these words kind of frame this in a way that is kind of maybe surprising to us. You're saying, in reality, creativity requires a complex set of skills, attitudes, and actions. I mean, much more important than thinking outside the box would suggest. Intimately related to imagination, innovation, and entrepreneurship. Here's the part I love. To harness our creativity, we need a robust set of definitions for all parts of the creative and entrepreneurial process.
Right.
But I think that's so intriguing. I think most of us, when we think about creativity, think of it as something that, by its very nature, needs to be unleashed and not harnessed or limited in any way. And, of course, in a sense, that kind of creativity is so aimless that it ends up maybe accomplishing nothing or very little. And this notion of harnessing creativity for a productive end, that's really valuable, and probably especially valuable for people that we immediately and most obviously think of as being creative.
But think about it. We harness our physical abilities when we become an athlete, or our artistic abilities when we become, you know, a painter, or our musical abilities. You know, we have all of these innate abilities, and yet if they're not used and harnessed, we don't have a coach, we don't have someone who's going to help us really use our muscles the right way and to look at things in a very thoughtful way as an artist, we end up being very sloppy. And the same thing is true with creativity. With a framework, with a set of tools, you can really focus your abilities and make yourself stronger. I mean, just as if I exercise, I make my muscles stronger. If I use my creativity in a very thoughtful way, I get stronger at that as well.
Absolutely. And towards that end, this book then really helps us sort of understand this whole process.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Right. So you craft something which you call at one point a scaffolding of skills, which is important here. And it helps us distinguish between terms which you yourself say you've often used indiscriminately, as though they're pretty much the same thing. And the longer you have explored this, the more you realize that these terms are each distinct from the other. The terms are imagination leads to creativity, creativity to innovation, innovation to entrepreneurship. But we need to make sure we're really clear about imagination, creativity, innovation, and how they are each their own unique step in this process.
Yeah, and this is really important. And you bring up the fact that I do admit that for years I used the words interchangeably. You know, people conflate the words imagination and creativity. You know, they use them interchangeably, or creativity and innovation. But I realized that's a huge missed opportunity. So the framework that I create is very simple, and I wanted it to be simple so that it's easy to remember and then easy to harness. So the idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't yet exist. Pretty simple, right? It's something we do all the time. Okay? Creativity is applying our imagination to address a challenge. But we might be coming up with a solution that's been invented before. That's fine. It's new to me. It might not be new to the world. Innovation, though, is applying that creativity to come up with really unique solutions, things that are unique to the world. And entrepreneurship is applying your innovation to bring the invention of whatever sort to the rest of the world. Now, at each step along the way, there's a set of actions and attitudes that are required to get you to the next step. I liken this to the process of learning to talk, right? We start out with sounds we make. We apply those sounds to make words, apply those words to make sentences, and those sentences to make stories. And that same sort of hierarchy applies when going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship.
Hmm. I think as I glanced at your book the first time, the part that was maybe the most surprising to me was trying to take apart something like imagination. Because I think most of us, when we think about imagination and being imaginative, we think of that as something that, you know, maybe we have it or we don't. I mean, an entirely innate ability that some people have in great quantities and others seem to scarcely have any imagination at all. But generally speaking, I think most of us think of it as something that either you have it or you don't, like you're a blonde or you're a brunette. And of course,
I guess you can change that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, no kidding. But you really help us understand that imagination is a tool that can be fostered and nurtured just like anything else.
You see that. In fact, there are some interesting surprises in this. When I started digging into it, I realized, you know, most people think about that their imagination is something that you just sit around with your eyes closed under a tree and you're imaginative. Well, that's one way to do it. But really, most great ideas come from starting with a set of data. The more experiences you have in the world, the more you have to work with, because your imagination is essentially connecting, combining things that already are in your mind. This is why people who live in very enriched environments can have much more rich imagination than those who grew up in a very limited environment. And so the more engaged you are in the world and the more really active engagement, paying attention, listening better, watching better, you know, feeling things more deeply, the more you have to work with and the more you can envision what might be different. In fact, it's critically important to realize that our passions, our ideas about what could be, are designed after we're engaged. Before it's your passion, it's probably something you know nothing about. And this is really important because you can do anything from waiting tables to taking a trip around the world, and those experiences are going to really light up opportunities.
Hmm. So one of the steps you lay out is the importance of moving from engaging in the world with the world in a fashion that fosters our own curiosity to this idea of then envisioning. And this is probably an important step that a lot of us don't fully appreciate.
Yes. As I just mentioned, right, you engage first and then you envision what might be different. You know, your passions and the things that you care about follow that engagement. I tell a number of stories in the book of people who are going about their lives in a very expected way, and then something happens to them that triggers their motivation to do something differently and to solve a problem.
Hmm.
And that can happen to any of us. If we're actually paying attention, we start seeing places where we really can make a difference and address the challenges that are around us.
I appreciated how you help explain why this envisioning skill sometimes erodes over time. You write at one point, the ability to visualize is critically important for imagination. Unfortunately, as we get older, most of us aren't encouraged to practice this skill. Beyond childhood, we stop telling imaginative stories ourselves and focus instead on reading other people's fiction. We stop making artwork and begin looking at other people's creations. I guess one of the reasons this leapt out at me is because my full-time job happens to be teaching music in a college setting, and my wife is a music teacher. And it seems like there are a lot of forces at play in the world which are all about maybe the STEM areas of study, mm-hmm. and in particular also you know, business and management and so on, important areas of discipline of study, which can sometimes crowd out the arts. And you are writing here in a way which suggests that that there is a very important place for that kind of study, if for no other reason in just fostering your ability to be creative and imaginative in other arenas in your life.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I was at an art show last night. A friend of mine was displaying some artwork, and I went up to one of the paintings, and it said, you know, artist and the name of the artist. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Does that person define themselves as an artist? Does that mean that I'm not an artist? Right? I'm a musician, artist, writer. Well, I'm a writer. You know why I'm a writer? Because I write. You know, you're an artist if you actually pick up a paintbrush or, you know, some clay. You're a musician if I could, you know, bang some pots together and start making music. I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, but I feel as though by labeling people in this way, it means that the other people label themselves as not that, right? I'm not an artist. I'm not a musician. I'm not a writer. But, of course, we all have these skills. And I really am a huge believer that these are things we should be baking into our lives in all different ways. Yes, I might not be painting all the time, but to know that that's something I could do, you know, I could pick up a paintbrush and express myself that way. Why not?
Absolutely. And of course, it's only when you're given those opportunities and the invitation and the encouragement to do so that you might even discover creative outlets you didn't even know were there. And,
exactly.
And who knows the ways in which they might be applied, particularly when we get good at this thing called reframing, which you talk about a little later in the book. But one of the most important things that one can do in bringing about innovations and successfully bringing them to the world is not being stuck in the same framework of the present.
Yeah, I spend most of my time teaching. This is what I focus on, is how do you reframe problems? How do you look at a problem from very different angles to come up with really different solutions? I'll give you just a really simple example. Let's imagine we were a friend of ours was having a birthday, and we were going to brainstorm about a birthday party. Let's have a birthday party, and let's come up with ideas. If we change one word in that prompt from let's plan a birthday party to let's plan a birthday celebration, we've now opened up the frame of possibilities. The question you ask is the frame into which the answer will fall. So if you don't ask the question properly at the beginning, you're not going to get as rich a set of solutions.
Right.
And so by just thinking about looking at the problem you're trying to solve in really different ways, subtle to very bold new perspectives, you end up coming with really, really different solutions.
One of my favorite moments in the book that speaks to that is where you had a various teams in one of your classes engaging in brainstorming, and one of the teams was supposed to rethink movie theaters, and they came up with all kinds of interesting ideas, including one in which maybe people, while they're watching a movie, would all be on stationary bicycles. I mean, getting their exercise while they watch this this two-hour movie. I mean, what a fabulous idea. But if the framing of the question was such that the task was to take present-day movie theaters and do what they do just a little better or come out ahead of their competitors, that leaves you stuck in the original frame. But when the question is framed in such a way that you can envision an entirely different kind of movie theater.
Right.
I mean, it's just thrilling to think about the possibilities that, in a sense, are out there just waiting to be discovered or thought of.
Right. That was part of an exercise where I have the students unpack all the assumptions about something. So that was part of all the assumptions of a movie theater or the assumptions of a fast food restaurant or the assumptions about airline travel or hotels. You can pick whatever topic you want. You unpack all your assumptions, and then you turn them upside down. So one of the assumptions was, of course, that you're sitting there quietly, and they questioned that and said, gee, what if we ended up, you know, sort of combining a spin class with a movie theater, and you had sort of a spin class where you're watching a movie, and one of their ideas was you pay at the end, right? If you end up, the more exercise you do, the less you pay for the movie. So the idea is that you actually have an incentive, even a financial incentive, to get more exercise.
Mm. Well, there's a whole lot more to be discovered in this wonderful book, which takes us all the way through this cycle, including all kinds of important insights on what it means to take this to that that stage then of entrepreneurship and of persisting through barriers to bring an innovative idea to full fruition. The book again is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. It's in the author, Tina Selig. Professor Selig, this was a great pleasure for me to read your book and to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht pays his monthly visit to the program. On Monday, we'll be previewing the first documentary that airs in a new season of the PBS series POV. On Tuesday, local cartoonist John Hambrock, his wonderful comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, is syndicated to newspapers across the country. We'll catch up with John Hambrock on Tuesday. And next Wednesday and Thursday, John Rozelle, originally from Racine, talking about his new memoir, which recounts his experiences spending most of his childhood in the Taylor Children's Asylum, an orphanage on the south side of Racine. It was torn down in 1972, but the children who grew up there remember it vividly. And David Rozelle, for one, remembers those experiences and his experience at the Taylor home with tremendous fondness. A surprising look at an orphanage. That'll be next Wednesday and Thursday. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is